Now we'd actually like to have 20 minutes of questions for these two panelists, and then we will take a short break before the other final two papers.
Hi. Sure. Great job, both of you. I actually have a couple questions for each person. Mm-hmm. Ben, for your first, you speak of the need to develop, like at a young age, you're developing this identity and how that can help prevent and both treat pre-psychotic patients and prevent, hopefully, psychosis from occurring. Economically, where's the motivation? Just in terms of, because pharmaceutical companies, they're making a lot of money from the research and the development of these various drugs. So where do you see like that we could develop some kind of an economic motivation for these programs to develop?
Well, I mean, obviously, I don't necessarily have this pharmaceutical company's economic interests in mind, but it seems like, you know, with the further employment of people who would be basically applying these programs full time, you know, there's people who would necessarily economically benefit from being the providers or teachers of these programs. It's hard to say that, you know, I present, you know, in combination with Professor Greenfeld's argument, I present a paper that's logically, you know, it makes sense that, you know, schizophrenia is predicated on a lack of identity. And it's obviously, I understand that not every person in America is going to be like, okay, awesome, this paper makes great sense. Let's do it. I'll pay, you know, X amount of dollars extra in my taxes so that my kids won't be schizophrenic. And obviously, I understand that that's not reasonable or realistic.
But you're going to develop this.
That's what I'm doing. Hopefully, I will be able to create a framework that seems like it would make sense and could be applied reasonably. I do understand that, you know, it's very basic at the moment, but understanding that people are definitely going to be resistant to spending extra money on things that they don't necessarily believe in. But the pharmaceutical companies, as one of the things I didn't necessarily talk about, is that there's institutional resistance to changing to a non-drugs first type of psychiatric treatment. The companies make money, and the physicians who are actually prescribing their money also make money by prescribing one drug over another. And so clearly there's institutionalized resistance to changing to a radically different and actually helpful paradigm. But, you know, here's hoping.
Right. So do you think there's, like, the possibility of developing maybe almost prototype, maybe working with a nonprofit or a foundation or something, setting up these kind of programs in conjunction with them and doing, like, an extensive research, we're talking, like, following these kids over numbers of years. But, I mean, do you think that would be helpful in being able to put forward the case for any kind of particular added tax or something like that?
Sure. I think it's definitely possible, but proving the absence of something is pretty difficult. So even if I apply this program and the kids don't have schizophrenia, then they'll be like, well,
what did
you prove?
Right.
Well, this is the question that seems like we were talking about, I don't know, 2 weeks ago. I mean, you said, you know, helping children create an identity. Well, so the question then becomes, well, it's two pieces, right? First, what is a healthy identity for a child? But trickier than that, how does that get created practically in an individualistic society like this one? Mm-hmm. I mean, because I didn't hear, like, I don't, like, what is it? I mean, that's the big question. You can't create a program to create, help a child create an identity unless we know what that looks like. And, you know, you mentioned things that I believe could be, you know, for some child, you know, some kind of community involvement, right? Well, the problem with some institutionalized group-based program is that one parent or one group over here doesn't want their child to be involved in this, for whatever ideological reasons, right? And that's the central value of our society, that no, that's not going to be my identity, so therefore it's not going to be my child's identity either, right? Or my child can only have these options, right? So then this child still has these options to form an identity, be part of this group. But, I mean, like, practically, is this even possible?
When I was thinking about this and, like, how it can be implemented, I figured, like, probably the easiest way to do it is through the education system, because it's something that already exists and something that, you know, changes all the time with, like, you know, how to, like, teach students different formulas of, you know, methods and stuff like that. But one of the largest barriers I can see, and from my own experience, is family. And because we have a lot of parts to ourselves. And so, you know, gaining like a strong identity when you're at school or, you know, when you're out in the world can only go so far, because that's one part of yourself. But a much larger part, at least in my experience, a much larger part of myself was developed at home. Mm-hmm. And that sort of acted as a barrier to forming my identity in school. And so I think that's probably something you can explore when you write your paper, is this interaction between home life and school life and, you know, primary socialization and secondary socialization.
I just want to add off of that. Well, one thing that you can do is not specifically programs, you know, this is how you must be, you know, your identity. Our entire society is based against an idea that there's sort of a one path for people, that you're born into, this is, you know, your father's a shoemaker, you'll be a shoemaker. But what you can understand and what can be helpful is just understanding the process. And so an entire, you know, just change of understanding that we have minds and that, while not perfectly controlled, that you do have some control over your own mind and your own identity and your own life. So just to help people see that they have to choose their identity, you know. Like, even just the simple maxims you learn in school of you can be anything you want to be.
Right,
but they don't follow up with but it's very difficult, and you do have to come up against, you know, people. But it can maybe happen if you fight very hard. But you may fight hard and it still might not happen.
Right,
you know, like,
right.
Just the follow through.
I sort of see that we have come to a place where we have more after-school programs. We have more things where people can do, more things where they can choose. And I would actually be concerned that it's the other way around, that the fact that we're having more programs, we're asking kids at a pretty young age to choose what they want to be involved in, could actually be causing them, rather than giving them an identity, rather than telling them, you are this, it's actually more stressful. What do you think?
I think, I mean, that's definitely, you know, that's the same fundamental problem that adults have, you know, like late teenagers when they're like, you know, what, I cite an example of, you know, a feudal Japanese peasant didn't have to worry about what college he was going to. You know, he didn't have to worry about all these things because it wasn't his choice. And so I agree that it's definitely something to explore, that is there, you know, what, is it more valuable to give kids or almost make high-risk kids through, you know, very specialized surveys to determine what high-risk kids, is it more stressful to put a kid who's not going to be good at sports on a sports team, and then that's really stressful, and then what else should I be doing, you know, all these types of things to make him even more anonymous? Is that, like, completely the opposite of what you're trying to accomplish? And that's definitely something to consider. It's just, it's clearly that when you're accessing or trying to access a symbolic cure to a symbolic disease, you have to access it symbolically. So that it's very difficult to think of any other way to help.
Well, yes. I actually wanted to follow up on that with a couple of things. First off, any doctor who took money from a pharmaceutical company in order to prescribe medication would lose his or her license. That doesn't
not directly, yeah. Just like through conferences and other kinds of.
But I just want to make it clear that there isn't that kind of thing. On this question, though, of integrating individuals into an individualistic society, I really like what Katrina said, and I want to follow up with that kind of, you know, cultivating that kind of self-awareness with the point that, I don't know, your name?
Anna.
The point that Anna just made, which is that what our society has to do well is cultivate an ability to create self-generating individuals, individuals who are capable of creating their own individual personality. And I think we need to do that on two ends of the pole. On the one hand, having a sense that there is a broader society into which they can expect to be integrated. And in that sense, we actually do want the largest possible solid set of norms so that they feel like this, you know, energy and activity of creating themselves is pointing towards something worthwhile, that, you know, the effort it takes to make yourself into a doctor is going to be rewarded. The effort it takes to turn yourself into a lawyer is going to be rewarded by a position in a state of society where that's recognized. But on the other hand, just to pick up on what Anna said, we are not helping them to, you know, create themselves if we are continually programming them with after-school programs. I mean, that's almost, you know, the creation of a Durkheimian tribal situation where you're continually given a totemic identity rather than being given the opportunity to create yourself through choice. So I would just, I'm a little worried about that. I'm a little worried about putting too much outside packaging on individuals who have to be busy creating themselves.
I'd like to add something following all of those comments and basically addressing David's question. Well, first of all, my main idea as to how education may help in combating those mental diseases is precisely what Katrina said. It is providing people with control, with the ability to control the situation, the social situation, simply through the understanding of what it is about. And of course, this is not now done anywhere in any framework that exists. And I think that in the many years that of modernity seminar, we got a lot of proof that just understanding the nature of modern society helps people to deal with sometimes very serious mental problems. But in addition to that, and this addresses actually both of your papers, the best way to test a hypothesis is through comparison. And when you know that your explanation is consistent with data, then solutions suggest themselves. So, for example, in Henry's paper, if we simply compare the statistics for whether it is PTSD or combat stress, right, for the Second World War, for the Vietnam War, it is very suggestive that the diagnosis was created after the Vietnam War, and the current wars. And if we compare those statistics and we see that in the most horrible Second World War, there was a significantly smaller percentage of this suffering. And in the other wars, again, quite independent of the brutality of the combat itself, there was a growth in the rates of PTSD, then we should understand what is it. It is not then the brutality of warfare. It is something else, right? So the most immediate something else would be the change in the social mood, right? The war was supported as a very just and heroic effort during the Second World War, and it was those people who were risking their lives and losing their friends and going through horrible things were returning to face public outrage mm-hmm. in the other wars, right? Obviously, that is an anomic situation. Then you can be sure that it is anomie that creates those higher rates of post-traumatic stress disorder in the military. So similarly, we could compare, and I don't know about those statistics about, that you mentioned, but about mental disease, I know very well. We know how they grow. We know, for example, that there was a tremendous increase in the 60s. What happened? Why was there an increase? So that it those rates were much lower before the 60s and for cohorts born before 1944, I think, is the cutting point, and cohorts born after 1944. Then there has been another increase in the 80s, kind of a jump increase. So the question is, what really happened? Wouldn't it be good for us to return to the situation before 1944, you know, somehow? United States, for a long time, trailed behind European countries in mental disease. For a long, long time, there was mental disease in the United States very early in its history, and yet it trailed behind. More than that, mental disease was almost entirely concentrated within the top strata, and now they're not. So all those statistics can very much help us to understand the underlying factors, right? So, for example, if we did, and this Anna also suggested that, if we did even so little as to limit the choices for little children, that would be good. If we did so much as to emphasize how wonderful it is to be an American, because America is a wonderful society. You know, many people do think so. Certainly outside of the United States. Well. So, you know, if we taught this to little children, yeah.
Well, the problem is when I think about children with mental illness or problems with identity, I also think about problems with identity which are just as destructive, though not necessarily manifested in mental illness, in terms of groups of children growing up in segments of society, particularly inner cities, who end up selling drugs, going to jail, in gangs, getting pregnant at a young age, telling them that America is a wonderful place. I mean, that's... You actually have to tell the kids, because I've thought a lot about this, you actually have to tell them, actually, America's a wonderful place because there are ways out of the situation that you were born into. But the situation you were born into isn't a particularly good one.
Right.
That's not a politically correct thing to say in a public school.
Well, you see, the interesting thing here, you're absolutely right about that. Lying is never good. But when it is contradicted every day by experience, it is very bad for the mental health of those to whom you lie. But the interesting thing about this country is that it is not the inner city schools where people are saying that America is a horrible society. It is precisely in those inner city schools where this message is propagated. Maybe it shouldn't be propagated in inner city schools. But it is in the privileged schools that children learn that America is a terrible society.
Perhaps because, I mean, we could go on and on about that.
Well, look, it doesn't have to be...
Identity. Yeah, that's exactly what I meant, that people should feel like the society that they are aspiring to integrate into is a worthy society.
Right. Well, it's
but they should be aware of the limitations as well.
Well, but when you teach a person to begin with, and this addresses, I think, also Griselda's question, when you teach a person that this is modern society, there are all those influences, that it consists of individuals, and the individuals in different positions, in inner cities and in privileged schools, are being burdened with personal responsibility. When you teach them this message that Katrina was talking about, then they, by necessity, acquire the idea as to what is expected of them and what they may expect of life, you see? So you make the attacks of enemy much less probable.
No, I mean, more a version of what Katrina said is exactly what I've been talking to people about this for, like, a long time, and some version of that is what I've said that children have to be taught.
Yeah.
But practically, the only way children learn that is if adults learn that first.
Of course, mm-hmm. you first have to educate the educators. Mm-hmm. This is how, unfortunately, this is how it should start. It should start in universities.
Right. Her point about the family, though, I think is extremely important because, as in many family problems as you want to diagnose in modern society, in an individualistic society, part of what we get to do is teach our children what we want to teach them.
Right.
And I know growing up, spending 9 years in going to Christian school and then entering this other world, mm-hmm. you know, there was this conflict. There was this thing at home. Then there was this thing at this Christian school where we were still, where we had this, like, filtered influence of, like, the rest of the world. And then I went into the rest of the world.
Yes.
And so there are families that obviously are not necessarily okay with their children just go to school and listen and, you know, to everything, you know, your teacher says. And there is not necessarily an integration between the home and the school.
Right.
And as long as that is the case.
Yes, but precisely through teaching people about the nature of modern society, you will achieve this integration. Because this is what the nature of modern society is, that there is no integration. So a child who comes from a really different family would be taught, yes, there are really different families. This is one of the facts of life. So then a child from such a family like you, that child would be told, necessarily faces greater difficulty. Well, poor child, we will try to help you. You know, and this child would...
That's fundamentally a problem because the whole point of being different is being right. You're not different for the being the sake
yes,
of being different.
Child,
you're different because that's the right way.
But the child does not know that.
But the parent who sends their children off to school knows that.
But the parents send this child to school where completely different messages are given to the child. At least this would be addressed, that some parents may truly believe that they're doing right. But at the same time, the school system also believes that they're doing right. So it is up to you, dear child, to deal with that.
Right, and
but at least one is prepared.
But what I'm saying is, no parent is going to send who believes that they're right is going to send their child into an environment where they're going to be like, learn to patronize your parents as you grow up, because they sincerely believe, as we do, that we know what's best for you.
But they send their children like you were sent into the world. But you were sent into the world. You see?
I'm not saying that this is a better alternative. I'm just saying that I'm just not particularly optimistic, I guess, is what this comes down to.
Well, this we will have to work on.
Yes, that will be your greatest project.
I'm kind of more on your wavelength. We're just a little bit cautious about this whole thing, and like it sounds good on paper, but could this ever actually work in our society?
Jenna, of course everyone should be cautious. You think that I'm just so completely mad that I think tomorrow everything would be all right?
No, I know that. And, but even I guess thinking, like, trying to come up with some systematized way to even tell young children everything is your own choice is...
Oh, this should never be told, a young child. Yeah.
Or, I mean, but you have to create your own identity. And through some... I just don't even think... No, have
no,
to say,
not that. No. Okay, you see, what Katrina was saying is that, you said, this is how this society works. It places upon you the responsibility to make your own identity, but it is very difficult to do.
Well,
this is a very
heavy. You have a choice. You're essentially telling that child, this is the way the society works. Anybody, like, every
you have
exists.
A choice not to do it. You have a choice to resist it. You see? Precisely. Katrina, could you explain again? Because I think you're doing it much better.
But whenever, like, the child, so you're taking a child that has contradictory things. Maybe there's something in school that's taught one way, parents that are teaching them a different way, whatever, it's just a friend that has different beliefs.
Right.
So they're to say that you have the responsibility to create your own identity, you automatically have to say, you have to admit, yes, these are choices that people are making. This isn't something that's concrete and definite
right.
for you. It can always change. And I
right.
think that might be something dangerous or not.
These are choices that the society gives you. You don't have to take them. I mean, this is the most important thing. The society gives you all of those choices without any explanation and without telling you what you have to pay for them. So this is the most important thing, to say, well, this is how it works. And there were those other societies where it worked differently. But in those other societies, people were serfs. Would you like to be a serf? And then maybe the child decides, yes, he would like to be. That would be really fine, no decisions to be made. Then you would tell this child, well, there are such and such possibilities in this society where you more or less can be like a very carefree serf. But maybe he doesn't want to be, or she doesn't want to be a serf. Then you say, well, then there are such and such prices to pay. You have to decide. Do you want to be like your parents want you to be? Or do you want to be like that friend of yours that is different? Or like, in some TV program? This is what is important for you to understand.
But I understand what she's saying, because setting up like that choice for a child is very traumatic in and of itself. Even though you are giving them the consequences that come along with it, they're not able to base themselves. If you're saying, well, you can choose either what your family tells you or what your school tells you, then you become baseless.
Yeah.
Because when you, like, take away your family from underneath you or take away your school from underneath you, it's
but
just
you. But you see, Rosetta, the choices are here. They are given. The problem is that they're not being made explicit.
No, I know. And I know it's like that now anyway. And we're not being told the consequences.
Exactly.
So it's even worse right now.
That's what I'm saying.
Right.
You cannot make those choices disappear.
Right.
No education
exactly.
system can make it disappear.
It's traumatic.
They
no
do exist. They do exist.
You
just try to explain them. And then at least the child understands what is happening and understands what expects him.
Because in an individualistic society, you really
yes.
have no base.
That's right.
Okay. Unfortunately, due to time constraints of the conference, we're going to take a quick 10-minute break so we can thank these two panelists again. And then after a quick stretching of the legs, a little more nibbles, we will have our final two presenters and then a little more discussion and concluding remarks.